Fantastic Pixel Castle and Frog Pants Studios presents Word on the Street with Greg Street and Scott Johnson.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Word on the Street. It's that time of the month. It is July 2024, and we happen to be recording this on the 16th of July, one day shy of a horrible day known as my birthday. So don't even tell me about it. I don't like even hearing about it. I don't even know why I brought it up. It's a terrible idea. I am here, of course, with Greg Street. As always, Greg, welcome back. How are you?
Happy birthday, Scott.
Oh, crap. Well, look, you and I are we are men of a certain age, and we may as well embrace this because it's not going to last very long. It's good to see you, and I'm excited to talk yet again. Today, we have a big focus coming up on art design and overall sort of direction for the game, which is, I have to admit, one of my favorite things about gaming. I love that part of it. I love hearing about the process and what it takes to get there. And so we're going to welcome some guests with us today. We have a triumphantly returning, Shanti Blease. Welcome back, VP of Creative. Shanti, how are you?
Hey, great. Thanks for having me back. I wasn't going to show up, but I heard it was your birthday, so here I am.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it very much. It's making the day so much better. We also have with us for the first time, and hopefully not the last, we have David Kubelak, art director of all things Ghost over at Frog Pants Studios. That's not the name of this thing. Fantastic Pixel Castle. It's great to have you here, Dave. Welcome.
It's great to be here, Scott. Thanks for having me.
I'm told to call you Kub from here on out.
It's a lot easier to say than Kubelak. So
yeah. All right, I'm all in. There was a character in a TV show I remember had that Kubelak name, and I don't know, you somehow remind me of him. It's a long time ago and I don't remember the name of the show, so I'm not gonna figure it out while we're here. But it's great to be back, everybody. We're gonna talk about a lot of stuff today, mostly in the area of art direction, but we got a phone call. And Greg, this is really, a lot of this is for you because you've been through the process of trying to deal with what it means to preserve a game as a service, how to take something like, in our example, World of Warcraft, and maybe make it last longer than its whatever its shelf life was going to be. And even though the game's still going, I think it's a good example of where Classic came from. Maybe that surprised a few people. Maybe that even surprised you a little. I don't know. But this phone call is all about that. So let's play this and address it real quick.
Hey, Scott. This is Colin in Seattle calling for Word on the Street. I was just listening to the recent Play Retro, and your conversation with Brian Dunaway about game preservation finally got me to get off my lazy butt and finally put a call in that I've been wanting to do for a while, which is, this is a live game MMO style that they are going to be creating. And what plans, if any, do they have for game preservation, whether that is online services, whether that is code, you know, open source code, long term helps everyone grow and learn and build things, or building an open server or things like that that allows for creating and mods and other forms of experimentation. But love the show. Can't wait to hear what I'm sure is going to be a great discussion this month. Cheers.
Great question, Greg. I mean, it's early, right? Talking about preserving a game that isn't technically even out yet, but it has to be on your mind a little bit.
Yeah. There's like two ways to answer that. The first one is, when you're making a game, you're very focused on, like, let's ship this thing. And I wasn't on World of Warcraft, when it launched, but I heard enough stories that, like, they were just trying to get the game out. Like, the last thing on their mind was like, well, what if this game is a huge hit and down the road people are going to want to, you know, come back and remember it? It's always this delicate balance of, like, let's plan for huge success when, you know, the first, it's so hard to make a game in the first place, let alone plan for 20 years of victory or something like WoW has had.
Right.
The second part is the technical side, which at the time on World of Warcraft, like the very simple way to explain this is there was one version of the data. So if you made changes to the data, you were making changes to everything. So there was no like way to go kind of roll back and like, well, let's go look at version 12 when we're on version 18. Like that just didn't exist. I know that because we were working on this really cool feature called Event Realms, which they now, thank goodness, have mastered. But at the time, technically, there was no way to have like different versions of the game up at once. So even if we had wanted to do a classic version of Warcraft, technically we couldn't at the time. Now, my understanding is the team actually kind of went back and manually recreated the data, like they found a version of vanilla running on an old machine somewhere and just used that as the template. And since then, they've re-architected everything so they can have multiple versions. And you see that right now as they have like four or five versions of WoW running. So for us, like, we can certainly learn from that. And right away, we talked about, hey, we need to like preserve old versions of the data just so we can like go back, roll back, go look at old things, you know. Mm-hmm. Again, planning for success here. But if we do have a great game and people want to kind of revisit the early days, you know, we should be able to do that technically.
Yeah. We even have some old video footage of our first play tests and all of us laughing at how ridiculous our game looks. So maybe less useful to future open source developers, but maybe it'll be funny for some players to see in the future.
Yeah. Yep. I wonder from like the artist perspective, David, like when you go back and see old work, and in this case, it's a team you're running. It's many artists. It's, you know, your stamp is on it, but it's also you directing a lot of other look and feel of the game. But when people talk about game preservation, you're also talking about preserving the old and ugly that you may think of years down the road. Like, I have to think in WoW's case, for example, there are people who look back at old classic textures or certain character design aspects or something else and just kind of cringe and go, ugh, you know, if we'd have known now or then what we know now, we wouldn't have done it that way. Do you worry about that a little bit as, you know, as the future comes?
There's not much that you can worry about with it, because especially with a game like WoW, I mean, it lasted 20 years. Like, even if they wanted to keep the art similar, which I feel like they kept the essence of the art very similar, but they've updated it to make sure that it would look good, you know, as the art generations have kind of gone up. And we are very public, at least at FPC, about just the content that we're making. So it's very easy to just load up one file and see every piece of art that we had in 2023 and every piece of art we have in 2024. Yeah. And we always remember that the first two things that talked about our blue zones and the shards in the sky were two iterations of Greg's beautiful masterpiece, and we've since iterated on it. But, you know, even now we reference some of our older art and how it's kind of updated with our more recent ideas.
So, Greg, I don't know if I knew this before. Did you sketch out some stuff, like did some art that we haven't seen yet that they all get to see but the public hasn't seen? Like Greg Street drew a thing.
That's right. You know, I want to say when we did our announce video in that crazy Black Swan dining room space, that we showed like my initial sketch of like, oh, this is kind of what I have in mind when we're talking about this.
I got to track it down.
I'll see if we can dig that up.
Yeah, I want to see it.
It is in the AMA.
And that was, frame it. That's actually really great, because that kind of kicks off the discussion here, because what we're talking about is the front facing look, tone, and feel of this game in perpetuity for as long as this game lasts. Let's say you get your 20 years before people start begging for classic or whatever. What you establish now is going to be important down the road, because it's going to be the look of the game. And a complete graphical overhaul usually just means better resolutions, lighting is improved, technical improvements overall, but you still have to kind of maintain your look. So we'll start by talking just quickly about the decision that you guys may be at the, I don't know if you're at the fork in the road right now, but the decision to go either very stylistic or go hyper realistic. Where are you at with that, Coob? Do you feel like you're, you know, are you on the precipice of making that call, or have you already made it?
Yeah, I feel like, and the group can kind of correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like we've made that decision for sure. Mm. Even from the beginning, you know, we kind of talked about the idea of where Ghost can go, and then started to form what the IP will be, what the setting is. And we said, well, this game will not be ultra realistic. And we also said this game will not be cartoony. And in my mind, anytime something isn't realistic, it's a version of stylized. So in a lot of ways, our look will be somewhat stylized, but not overly stylized. If it starts to look cartoony, if it starts to feel too bouncy and whimsical, that's likely not going to be a fit, you know, for our game. But do we want the look to be timeless? Absolutely. You know, do we want to make sure that this is going to a broad audience, that people are able to look at you know, the screenshots, the vistas that they're able to kind of like discover and be in awe. Yes, we definitely do. We want this to be a world, Shanti uses this term all the time, a world that he wants to spend 10,000 hours in. And as much as I love Diablo 4 or he loves Elden Ring, those are games that, well, I could still spend 10,000 hours in Sanctuary, but I think Shanti chooses not to spend those hours in Elden Ring. So,
and hopefully it's more than just me spending 10,000 hours. And if we do our jobs right, it'll be a lot of people. It's one of the most interesting parts of early game development is when you get your leadership team together and you say, what do we want our game to look like? What do we want our game to feel like? And you know, we had those, like Coop said, we had these very early conversations where we looked at really high fidelity, super detailed, unreal games. And we're like, do we want this? Do we need this? Right? If I see the individual hairs on my character's face, it's a lot of work to get that to that fidelity. Does it add a lot of value to our moment-to-moment gameplay? Do we think players want it? And there's no right or wrong answer, but gradually over time and conversation and looking at what's out there and looking at our own art, you start to narrow in on the answer. And that's where we are right now. We're narrowing in.
Just from a kind of a side view from somebody who plays a lot of games, my experience has been when people aim for hyper-realistic, it falls a little flat more than it would if you don't. And it's usually because of time, because hyper-realistic is, and what we're capable in that realm is different from what it was 10 years ago, what it was 10 years before that, and certainly what it will be 10 years from now. So when I even play a game like Elden Ring, which has a lot of realistic elements in a fantasy world, if you will, but, you know, trees look like trees and environments look, you know, very much like realistic stone and grass and ground and that sort of thing. But there's still stylistic design choices in the characters and the bosses that I think will make that thing not look old in 10, 15 years. And I think that's where WoW succeeded really well. They created a style that stood the test of time and still looks good today, even despite the updates that David mentioned. So I guess what I'd say is I not since maybe of EverQuest 2 have I heard a studio touting hyperrealism. I just feel like that's fallen a little bit off, and it's more about effects and particles and spells and animation and that sort of thing.
It's about the visual design a lot of times. So we talk about how we're designing the art in our game rather than how detailed or how high fidelity the art is.
Right.
Coop, what do you think?
Yeah, it's absolutely right. We kind of break down the visuals into what we call visual design and visual aesthetic. And both are incredibly important. And the visual design is going to be why the world looks the way that it does. Is the architecture different? Is the fashion different? What are the races and civilizations? How does that stuff all come together? But then the visual aesthetic is potentially the style. And I think why, you know, you pointed out a great thing there, Scott, of why so much is going into effects and animation. It's because it's for the reaction of the players. It's making that experience better. It's immersing them into the experience, because what is actually happening with people that are trying to chase the ultra realistic graphics in a game they want to last 10 plus years is it can't stay on that bleeding edge of technology the entire time.
Right.
Because the technology, especially now, is going so fast that it is incredibly hard to keep up with. And I feel like Elden Ring, you know, is a perfect example of something that just looks like pure artistry. They take something that is inspired by realism, but of course, you know, stretch, you know, the boundaries of some of those things, and then also have a, you know, kind of aesthetic about every shot that you see that kind of reminds people, oh, that's definitely, you know, Elden Ring screenshot. It's very visible from the beginning.
So your time, you've known Greg forever. You guys worked together on Age of Empires, Orcs Must Die, Wild Cards, more recent stuff. And I was looking at this Orcs Must Die art, and I realized that so much of what made Orcs Must Die work for me as a series was this particular art style. I wouldn't call it cartoony. I would call it something maybe approaching that, but it's definitely a style that still, like, even just looking at it now, this still works for me. And the character designs, all of this stuff seems to inspire a lot of other things. I would call Fortnite sort of Orcs Must Die adjacent. And that game is huge and is known for its very particular art style. You do run the risk when that stuff's that popular that, you know, people get burned out on the look of a thing or whatever. But you've clearly got, you know, the chops and the time spent on other projects where this is, you know, what things look like is a consideration. And it's not just simply how good would this look in 5 years? It's how well will this mesh with other current technologies, like shader technology has come so far, and lighting technologies and other ways of just sort of rendering the world, view distances. I mean, that stuff alone is a massive improvement in the MMO space overall.
Yep.
With lots of games. So it seems like you as an artist and as a director of art have a lot more of a playground to mess around in now.
Yeah, definitely. And I love that you brought up, you know, Orcs Must Die, you know, and even the time back and at Ensemble with Age of Empires, because, you know, even though Greg and I knew each other since, you know, 2000, you know, after Ensemble, we kind of went, you know, some different paths. He went to Blizzard and I went to Robot and worked on games like Orcs Must Die. The other thing that's great about that is we also have our principal concept artist, who's also from Ensemble Studio and was our lead concept person on Orcs Must Die. So a lot of that look, you know, was kind of, you know, a lot coming from their hands, Bart Tjongson's hands, and bringing that to fruition. And so much of why we chose that wasn't even because of the way that it looked. We wanted a B-movie quality, you know, for the characters. We knew the game was about setting up a gauntlet of traps. And we thought the best kind of return on that experience would be going over the top with the actions, actually having like starbursts like pop on the screen and things like that. And once we were going with that over action, it was kind of easy to really tie that to, well, let's kind of have more of a tangible comic book feel to what we're going, you know, for the graphics, even punch up the way that all of the characters look against the backdrops. So that they will actually stand out, you know, when all of these things are flying. So it's really important to not just look at art for art's sake, and to not just look at art or the visual design for, well, what would be different from what's out there? If it doesn't match, you know, the game, the tone that you're making, it won't stay. It won't be, you know, like those kind of things that really gel, you know, with the audience. I think it's all of those things coming together and feeling that synergy that we can kind of have for the game experience when it really starts to kind of like be memorable for the audience.
Sure. And Shanti, it sounds like as VP of creative, this is you're the dude standing at the crossroads, kind of, right? Like you've got artists and concept people and people like Coob here in your ear, and you've got technical in your ear. Sure. That must be interesting to try to make all that work, right? Like obviously it's amazing to be surrounded by these amazing creative people, but what is that process like of just trying to balance all of it to make it, you know, to make it work?
It makes my job actually incredibly easy because, you know, I can just let them do all their crafts and then they come up with amazing things and I get to take credit for it. So here I am taking credit for it. I think it's actually maybe less of a crossroads, as you know, we're in the middle of the woods and there's no path anywhere, and we're trying to figure out where we can walk that'll be the best path forward. There is obviously technical limitations that factor into a lot of this, but there's actually a lot of gameplay requirements that factor into a lot of this, right? Because to Coop's point, the art style of Orcs Must Die was perfect for that game, for that thesis, for that core loop, for those characters. Is it perfect for our MMO? No, it's not, because we have a more mature tone. We have more elements of mystery and storytelling that weren't present in games like Orcs Must Die.
Right.
So it works best to find the path forward when you can not only look at what you have technically feasible, what your artists want to do and are passionate about, but also what the game needs.
Sure. And you've got, so let's get into some of that. You've got a place in this world called the Manta Isles. Well, first of all, why is it called that? Because it's shaped like it looks like a praying mantis, or not a praying mantis, a manta ray, a little bit. Okay. But let's talk about how you go from, we need a place and it's going to have stuff in it, and maybe Greg gives you a sketch on a napkin or whatever. I don't know what the process is with Greg, but, and maybe Greg can speak to this too, but like, I want to go from like that to, you know, what does that aisle look like? And then what is populating that aisle? Like, take us through the nuts and bolts of how this sausage starts and gets made.
I can start here because I had a pretty big hand in, I felt like the team was at a place where we needed to put some stakes in the ground for what is the game going to look like? What are our biomes going to be? And I felt like unless we just kind of committed to that, people would be nervous about like, well, what if the rest of the team doesn't like it? What if Greg doesn't like it? So we were at a team offsite and we did an exercise where I brainstormed, I think it was 16 possible biomes. And I wasn't, you know, advocating any of them. I just pitched them to the team and said, right now, today, we're going to vote on three of them. And voting is normally a terrible way to make decisions, and I don't advocate it. But in this case, I thought it would work fine because all 16 were viable, and who knows, maybe we'll get to them at some point.
In-game development, Greg doesn't hate democracy, just to be clear. In-game development.
I mean, yeah, consensus-based design often ends up wishy-washy.
Sure.
So the idea behind the Manta Isles was tropical, you know, Hawaii, Polynesia, you know, Caribbean, beautiful sand, beautiful water. And I specifically wanted to focus on manta rays because I'm a freaking oceanographer at heart. And they're a little weirder than, say, you know, sharks or whales or fish or things like that. I had gone on a trip to Costa Rica not long before where the rays will like leap out of the water and kind of flap in the air and then crash back down again, which is a really spectacular sight to see. And I thought, well, what if in this zone, the manta rays are all flying? Like instead of birds in the air, you just have manta rays flying everywhere. That was about it as far as what the pitch is. And from there, I kind of turned it over to Shanti and Coob to kind of say like, hey, run with this.
Yeah. And I'm looking at right now, we're looking at some creature concepts. I actually have a technical question for Coob that you probably get asked before. I don't know, but for those, and I think I know the answer to this because half of my work is illustration as it is, but when you always see concept art, it's always on a gray background. Do you want to give the technical reason why that is? Does it just make things pop? Is that the idea?
It's actually to not make it pop as much. When you're seeing it on the, like if you're looking at the just sketches at first, yeah, it really is just for ease of getting things out and not looking at the contrast of one design versus the other one. It helps them kind of look very similar. So if you're looking at a sheet of 20 different ideas, it helps them not stand out from one another because of what it's against for the backdrop.
Interesting.
Now, yeah, when it's an illustrated piece, it's the same thing. You want it to make sure that it looks good against more of a neutral background, because then you're able to push or pull it in low or high light intensity. So that's a lot of the reason why, because oftentimes your contrast of how you're painting the details will be very different if it's against a white or a black background.
Interesting. I think that's just good inside baseball. I think a lot of people see that and just accept it, and they don't know why it's done that way, but that's actually good to hear. So I'm looking at now a concept of what you guys have termed an orchid caiman. And it's got, what I love about this kind of thing is there's lots of little notes on it. Like, you know, this is the shark. Here's a shark fin in the rear. That's what this is inspired by. Yeah. And that sort of thing.
We left the notes in for
your stream.
Yeah.
For your stream specifically. Yeah.
I love that. I think that's cool. So I'm glad you left those in. But tell me a little bit about, like, we'll use him as an example. So this orchid caiman starts as whose idea and whose head and what's the process? How do we get to the end point?
Yeah, like one thing that I thought was really interesting, you know, about our process is, so Greg presented, you know, these 16 different ideas, and we kind of opened it up to the room. There was even plussing and minusing of ideas, and they brought up like other kind of creatures that might be there. So there were other details that we started to get out of that initial meeting that made some of these biomes even better ones to kind of pursue than some of the other ones. And Manta Isles was one of them. And some of the things that came out of it is, you know, potentially, you know, maybe the water area is like more, you know, knee high or things like that. And you're more traversing in the water and maybe not as much as on the land. So we were really trying to think, well, what would kind of be creatures that you would see that might just be able to submerge in some of that water and then leap out. And of course, something like a crocodile or an alligator felt like one of those things. A lot of designs that get to that point, like that creature, start with different ideas. We worked with a studio, I think we called them out in our blog post recently, Dardo Studios. We kind of gave them the prompt of what we wanted, started them with a couple ideas, and then they gave us a ton more. And this kind of caiman creature was one of them, and we loved it. We loved the kind of mixing some of the things between an alligator, you know, even some of the parts of the shark, but then making it something that also feels altogether unique. Because even though there will be things that we want people to at least be able to identify with, like have an idea of, well, is this an aggressive creature? You kind of know by looking at that it would bite you if you got close to it.
Yeah.
Or it might just even chase you looking for its next meal.
Yeah. And hopefully tether if you run fast enough, because that thing's scary as hell. So some of this, some of these illustrations of the zone, I love how you guys have so much floating stone, and like, I love that vibe. This, the kind of, I don't know what to compare it to. I guess in WoW you had what's Thrall's homeland zone? Forgot the name. Anyway, they had a lot of, what was that again?
Nagrand.
Nagrand. That's what I'm trying to say. Okay. Nagrand. Nagrand with all its floating stuff. I'll admit back in the day it was a bit of a revelation. I was like, oh, this idea of you got floating pedestal-y, you know, natural formations, just such a cool thing. Water flowing out of it. I'm getting some of that vibe here, and I absolutely love that stuff. Having looked at a lot of this concept art and even some of the initial stuff you guys put on the website, like day one when you guys launched it, it does seem like there's a lot of magic in the air that's holding a lot of stuff up. Are we going to see that kind of motif throughout other biomes, other parts of the game? Is that a thing you guys are even thinking about, or is it just something I'm noticing?
Oh, that's a great question, and I'm so happy you noticed that, because it means that the formula is working. So behind all of the art you'll see, the narrative you'll eventually read, is a creative direction, right? It's, this is what we want from our world. This is what we don't want. This is what we want to avoid. We have an inherently magical IP. So players are going to find things that are infused with fantastical elements that you wouldn't find in a normal world, because we think it makes for interesting levels and interesting puzzles and makes you want to go explore the world. Similar with our creatures. We don't want to just take an alligator and drop it into our world, because that's not the IP that we're trying to build. And so we say, what would an alligator look like in our universe? Ultimately, this is all in service of, we want to create this sense of wonder and mystery and exploration so that our zones are interesting to go spend time in. A lot of games do that really well. And, you know, when we're looking at stuff like Manta Isles, you can see some of the inspirations from other IPs or other games.
And there's nothing settled right now that says this is the starting zone for all the noob characters, does it? You guys, we're not to that point yet, are we, Greg?
Starting zones are honestly one of the last things you want to make in a game, just because you don't know until the game is farther along, like, what are the important concepts to teach people? Mm. So we have three biomes we're working on right now. Hopefully we ship with all three of them, but where players start, like, who knows yet?
Okay. Interesting. So I'd never thought about that before. I always assume, I don't know, this is like making film or whatever. They never film. Usually a film is not made consecutively scene per scene. It's usually like, oh, we filmed the ending a month ago and now we're doing the first part. And so I sort of understand that part of it. But in games, I'd never really thought about how the MMO structure would work. It makes sense to me that you wouldn't want to have locked in your starting player experience until you were sure that the body of the thing was ready. I don't know. I just never thought of that. I assumed you guys started there and then worked your way out. I don't know why.
You know, I mean, you just don't know what you need to teach. Like, we don't have our magic system completely worked out yet. So we don't know, is it important to teach players the magic system, or do we need to stick with basic things like, here's how you move and fight? And, you know, do we want a tutorial at all? Or do we want a game that kind of just starts you in the world and things come to you naturally? That seems to be a little bit more modern approach, rather than having a learn to play the game part that people want to skip through.
Yeah, that's true. It can be done. I think there's a good middle ground. You guys will probably hit it. Tell me a little bit about Tempest Desert. This is my, I haven't been here yet. I haven't seen it. I have certainly not seen it in game, and all I'm looking at is some art here, but this will be my biome of choice. I love deserts. I love deserts and MMOs in particular, and this looks amazing. Coob, let's talk a little bit about the concepts and stuff here.
And I think one of the other things to kind of point out is here it is, just another biome. And yes, we're not working on our first biome or, you know, the player's first experience, but we're just exploring what's possible. We're still not even saying that Manta Isles or Tempest Desert will be one of them. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of people would agree with you that they really hope Tempest Desert is one of them, because it's a really cool idea. You know, so when we were going through the ideas, it's like you said, almost every game, let alone every MMO, have a sand level, sand environment. So we knew we wanted to explore something around that. But we wanted to have our own kind of spin on it. And that's where the weather element came in. And not just weather, we really wanted it to be unpredictable and uncontrollable in a lot of ways. So we really kind of went with ADC, with partners with NetEase, and they kind of like took us on this journey, you know, where we kind of gave them some prompts. You know, they started like in this image messing with how do kind of fossils, you know, start mixing with the actual terrain, and then really pushing some of the things like the weather. And this one, we kind of wanted this water spout to be almost like draining the water out of the planet, and then not just having that, but then also having lightning striking around it and everything along those lines. And with a biome, just like when we were looking at the Cayman creature from previous, we have to imagine what are the creatures, you know, there are, what types of things would you encounter? So as we're working on this, we're thinking of the vegetation, we're thinking of the trees, we're thinking of the actual creatures that would inhabit here, because it's all part of that feeling of pioneering here, being all of the things that kind of like interact in this biome before you're actually going along and adventuring in it.
Yeah, these are, I'm looking at some of the creature designs here, and man, like, another thing I love about concept art, there's always a little person to compare scale. That makes this thing look like something I want to kill or ride or keep or whatever it is we're going to do with this guy. I want this so bad in my life. Look at this dude.
And the actual funny thing about that is there isn't always a person in there, but we always need it in there at some point in the process, because you don't necessarily know what the scale is. But as soon as you have that in there, it's very easy to understand. Oh, this isn't like a lizard-sized creature. This is like a dinosaur. Mm-hmm. And that was something really important for the Tempest Desert, because if we have long lines of sight, we wanted very big things that would be able to break those things up. So having these big, almost like dinosaur-like creatures was one of the things that we thought would be interesting for Tempest.
And this indicates to me, I mean, I don't want to jump to any conclusions, but just looking at this art and seeing those scale comparisons, which I think just, again, very effective, it seems like you guys are really going for that. You want big, impressive. I just walked into a zone and saw the biggest, gnarliest thing ever. I'm trying to think of a good modern example of, I guess Final Fantasy 16 has a lot of this, where the creatures or the I forget what they're called, whatever they are so big and so massive that it's just breathtaking. How much of that is a informing things, I guess.
Again, it's. I'm so glad you said that, because Titanic scale is something that we're specifically infusing into our world for a few reasons. One, it's cool as hell. Two, it's a great way to direct players in a zone to figure out where they want to go next and where they want to explore. So it's really tied into how we think players will spend their time in our game in terms of discovery. But also everything that Coop is describing in terms of when we have a foundation for a zone or a place in our world, what are the creatures that live there? What's the vegetation? What's the weather like? We kind of collectively call that effort world building. And so what you'll see is a lot of these elements playing off each other. You want this thing in the game to let players move in a certain way? How would that make sense in the world that we're building? We believe very, very much in the value of deep, rich world building, and we're hopeful that players end up feeling that in the best way possible.
It does seem like today, kind of back to some technical considerations, if you did this, I don't know, 20 years ago, you were really limited. You could create something that seemed sort of big, but it was usually kind of low polygon and you know, not that impressive. The old PS2 game, the something of the Colossus, forgot the first part of it.
Shadow.
How do I forget that? That game was so impressive and so amazing, and the scale was incredible and kind of off the charts. These days, even as stylistically as you may want to go, you can really create a lot of sense of large and small and far and close and all of those aspects. It just seems like this game's going to benefit from all of that. Looking at this concept art just makes me feel like I'm going to see some big gnarly stuff. And that's my favorite thing, to enter a zone or turn a corner. And I'm like, where am I now? What new part of this is happening? It's not just where's my quest. It's I can't believe there's a floating thing that's bigger than the city I just came from or whatever. And I can't wait.
Once again, I'm so happy that you're pointing those things out, Scott, because like Shanti said, it means things are working. Mm-hmm. One of the big things about our blue zones is having success in more environmental storytelling elements. And it's not just going to be about things being big or small. It's about how those interactions become memorable. You know, mm-hmm. So if we went back to that one and it kind of has those ruins and a lot of times it may just be the ruins, but one time when you're there and that lightning strikes away a certain way and that the lightning potentially circulates around it and makes a really kind of cool interaction, those are going to be things that people are going to remember, you know, about that. Mm-hmm. And I think even with some of these kind of things, this is kind of us exploring, well, what are our plants and trees, you know, like mm-hmm. on this? Some of the ideas of that is, well, how does this vegetation grow, you know, here? I think we even have ones interacting with the lightning and it's storing some of the energy for when, you know, it is, you know, a lot more dry, you know, over a long period of time and transferring that into things that will actually nourish it and allow it to grow. And I think those types of things and being able to see not just the animals behave, but seeing the plants and trees, how they interact, how the animals interact with that or creatures interact with that, I think is going to be a really, really cool thing for us to kind of explore.
I mean, at the end of the day, it's immersion, right? So I remember feeling this way in parts of WoW's timeline where I just could see the seams a lot more. I was playing it so much that I would fly into a zone and I would see NPCs or other players sort of fade in a little too closely. And it was just a reminder like, oh yeah, this is all about load balancing. It's about, you know, you start getting into why they have to technically do this or that. And if I fly too high, I can see that the texture on the ground is kind of in a grid and it's like repeating tile sets basically. And I just see that and go, oh, that's less than immersive or whatever. And it's not just WoW, any game, especially older games, they have this tendency. Probably the Holy Grail here, maybe the Unreal Engine is the answer because it can do so much, is to just create that layered painted world in such a way that when I fly into this place, I'll put up on screen again with this giant Sarlacc pit looking freaking meteor impact deal you got going. I mean, I can't wait to walk. I want to learn more. I want headphones on. I want everyone to leave me alone for the next 6 hours. I just want to walk around this place.
Yeah, there's a treasure chest at the bottom of that too. Ignore the key, but there's a treasure chest, I promise. A
little something down there to satisfy you. Okay, cool.
You just got
to
be as vertical as possible when you jump down there.
Yeah.
What I would say to that, Scott, is that technology is still technology. Unreal is amazing, and we're going to continually push what we can do with it to where once you get into those situations like flying above it, we're likely still going to see some of those breaks of reality. But what we hope the players are remembering is how amazing riding on the Griffin was, you know, like not thinking of like the potential details with it, because we want to make the 90% of their playtime as immersive as possible. And if that means in some of those things where we're just passing by, it's not able, you know, to be that same set of immersion, I think that's okay. You know, we're looking for the things that would be memorable to the experience. And I don't know if people would say, yeah, but when I went up in the air, you know, like it looked like a bunch of tiled maps. And I know you were just using that as an example, but what I'm trying to say from our example is trying to make sure we're benefiting the majority of the playtime and where it would actually kind of benefit the experience for the most part.
Right. Right. That brought up a technical question in my head about issues of scale when it comes to like, how do I put this? Like, I assume the engine's capable of this, but one of the beauties of, or one of the innovations I think WoW brought to the table was previous to WoW, EverQuest and others, if you wanted to go somewhere new, even if it was right next door to you, you had to phase in there, right? You had to, there was a loading screen. How important is it to maintain all of this illusion to not have that stuff or you know, how limited are we these days when it comes to, I need to phase into the zone next to us and it needs to be seamless and I don't want a load time.
I'm smiling because the design of our world means you are often going to these different shards. So I don't know if we'll actually even have the problem of I'm going to a different zone and there's a load screen, because almost by definition in our game, you're constantly going to new places and, right. And it won't be a load screen. We'll do something cool for the transition.
Well, there's a great question in the chat about that very thing. And it deals with blue zones in particular. Let's see if I can pull that up. This is from Mika. Says, are these biomes going to be generated in the blue shards? How much of that is going to be work for you guys, or how much of that will just be procedurally generated by you exploring them? Maybe a way to clarify that too is like, if you've gone from this beautiful desert vista and you've seen all these sorts of things, you enter that zone, which is supposed to be sort of tailor-made for your experience. I mean, are we going to see a lot of the same stuff suddenly pop up? Is it going to be just a weird mix of all the things you've seen? Maybe you can explain that a little better. Whoever's best equipped to do that.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and give it the start. So, like, I think it will be part of our procedural systems, and we're thinking of that in the broadest way possible. Is just like any ingredients, you know, like we're going to have the flour, the sugar and stuff like that to make, you know, what we're going to be doing with this biome. Mm-hmm. Now, if flour and sugar is used for something else, you know, like, and I made cookies and then I also made a pie, like they're not the same thing. And I think we're looking for that type of stuff whilst we're doing the biomes. We want to make sure that there are interesting points of interest or memorable moments that come up from playing biomes again and again and again, because we're going to have a large amount of assets that are kind of sprinkled into each one. Mm. And then there's going to be assets that are be able to use across more of them, and then also mixing some of the biomes together. So it's going to give us a pretty broad, you know, idea of how, you know, those things can kind of like come together. And if it feels too repetitive, then we know we have to kind of like add, you know, some more ingredients to make that a lot more unique.
And it's a great answer from Coop. Let me give you a bad one to just, you know, drag his great answer down. We talk about this a lot because anyone hears proc gen and myself included, the fear is like, oh, it's going to feel soulless and heartless. But the experience we want is for you to be able to go to a new blue shard every night with your friends and see something new. And oh, your friend couldn't make it. Oh, last night we found this insert super cool thing here. You missed it. Hopefully we find it again one day. And if we can get that level of replayability and discovery, boy, that's going to be such an awesome, awesome leveling or exploration experience for players.
Mm.
There will be like,
yeah. Go ahead, Greg.
It is inevitable that there will probably be some landmarks that you see more than once, because we're not going to procedurally generate every gigantic statue or amazing pyramid in the game. Like some of that probably you'll be like, oh, I think I saw that statue once before, but this time it's rising out of a volcano that I haven't seen before. Or this time it has a bunch of pteranodons perched on it that I haven't seen before. So it's a combination of procedurally generating the world, but then also using almost roguelike variants of there's a bunch of if then statements. And like sometimes the statue is in a pool of acid, sometimes the statue is vertically sticking out of a mountain or something like that. And that is how we'll get the sense of, oh, I haven't quite seen this before.
Right. Variety is the key there, right? Like right. Not just variety of where the statue is, but the variety of everything else affecting the statue. Here it's raining, here it's in lava, like you said, here it's dark, here it's light.
And we also just need 100 statues. Like you can't take 3 statues and have enough variation. There's still a lot of content for us to make. No, don't get me wrong. But even in most MMOs, they do cleverly reuse the content the way they like. It's the same house, you know, that the the humans use in World of Warcraft. They just have placed it in different locations, so it feels fresh.
Right, right. Yeah, that makes sense that that would, it's that sort of thing. And just variety, you know, the more you add in there, the more variety options you have, I guess. If, the more we talk about the game, it feels like, and Greg, I think this is mostly for you, it feels like expansion content, or whatever you guys will call it, will be very biome based. So a lot of expansions are, here's a new area or here's a new zone, but the zone is like a collection of, you know, various looks, feels, and whatever. And then maybe there's a new character class or something. And then the next time they do it, they flip it. It's instead of character classes, it's new races. It's kind of how WoW does it with that every other thing. But so far tonight or today, I've been getting this vibe that biomes are key, and they're also not like a thousands of them. Like right now, we're talking about two today. Is that a fair thing to assume that a lot of what you guys will have for like add-on content down the road, whether it's expansion or whatever name we call it, will be like new biome coming? Like, is that what players will be thinking when they hear a new expansion's coming? Like, I don't know if you've got anything that you can add to that, but it's.
Yeah. We've thought about this a lot, because the way you keep people engaged in an MMO is new content has to come at a pretty good clip. You start to see people drop off if it's like, oh, I've been waiting 18 months for something new. So mm-hmm. We are building in as part of our plan that we want to drop new content, I'll say idealistically once a year. And so rather than it feeling like expansions, we want it to almost feel like, oh, it's the next chapter that we kind of knew was coming because the story was pointed this way. And players are not surprised to see that the new biome is a favorite of mine that no one else on the team likes, which is a fungal forest, because they start to see some shards in the distance that look like they're covered with giant mushrooms. And so players may speculate, oh, I wonder if this means they're going to get a mushroom biome next chapter. So we're thinking a lot about that and how we not only, you know, surprise and delight people, but kind of hint there and foreshadow a little bit. So it doesn't just feel out of nowhere of like, oh, wait, we're going to Pandaria now. Like, how would I have predicted that? That's kind of out of nowhere.
You're right. I always like that conceit too, that there were mists, like the mist part of the name, it works for the name and everything, but I always loved how it was like, yeah, it was all covered up by clouds. We didn't know it was there.
Yeah. That was a good like excuse we had for like why no one had found it before. But
yeah.
It was, and I, you know, again, I love WoW, but having been on the inside, we would often say like, well, shit, we got to come up with a new expansion. What should we do? Where should players go? What's the new continent going to be?
Yeah.
And we want to plan we want to have a plan that extends out for 5 or 10 years so that we know what's coming down the road and we can start to hint at it. So when players see it, they'll be like, aha, I knew, you know, I predicted this was going to happen.
Interesting.
And I think to add to that, Scott, the other thing that, you know, happens with those chapters is the addition of potential add-in content.
Mm.
So yes, we're looking to potentially add new biomes. The new fungal forest, as Greg brought up, that is potentially looked at on the distance. But also, maybe there's some new creatures that do happen to come into Tempest Desert and or Manta Isles. Maybe there's some new points of interest that kind of like help push the environmental storytelling along, because it's a different blue zone that you're going to. And potentially, as we are, you know, giving more information about where the narrative is going, you're able to uncover those things even in some of the older kind of biomes and maps that you could be playing on. So it doesn't just become, I want to play all of my quests on the new one because it's the new hotness. Hopefully there will also be new things in the previous biomes as well.
Well, that's a great, that gives me a big question in my head about, I'm thinking about playing through these games and realizing that a lot of times the early content you're going to see, in WoW's case, Durotan, starting zones in games like Final Fantasy 14, you see these areas that have remained mostly untouched for the length of the game, although I guess Cataclysm messed some stuff up in Durotar pretty good, but that maybe is the one exception. But do you, I guess, maybe you just answered the question, but it would be nice to see these places not become the static also rans that they often become, that are only there because, well, you got called back to a city for a quest and you're there for a few minutes, but really you just want to get back to the new stuff.
We have such a good take on this.
Oh, good. I'm glad I asked because I'm really curious about that as a player.
Like, so we have one city on purpose because we don't want to have like six kind of empty cities. We want one city, and that city is going to evolve over time. down to the level of my favorite, like, tavern keeper died, and now the tavern keeper's daughter has taken over the tavern, but she's changed it for the worst. Like, we want players to gossip about things like that. Mm-hmm. And then on a bigger scale, we talk about things like, when I was in this, you know, this last biome, a big part of the story was bringing the, I'm making this up, the shadow druids kind of into the fold. And now when I go to the city next chapter, well, the shadow druids have set up a little enclave in the city, and the city actually evolves over time to show that. So that players can say, people who've been playing the game for years can say, like, oh yeah, I remember when the shadow druids weren't here and they didn't have their giant trees growing over everything. That sense of progression, we think, is really important. So the city feels like a real place that evolves along with you. Kind of the opposite of, like, the tavern key, the guy that sells you swords and shields who has been standing behind the same counter for like 20 years, you know?
Yeah, I always wonder about those poor NPCs that are just banging on anvils for 20 years straight. Oh, man. No, that's, as a player, I don't want to speak for everybody, but as a player, that's really exciting, because the promise of MMOs in the earliest days was more than just encounters, bosses, gear, whatever. It was more than that. The promise was these places would be living, breathing places, not just the people in them, but the world itself would be a place that would change and alter and whatever. And nobody's quite pulled it off. Not really. So I feel like you're saying you might be the first one that pulls it off.
It's ambitious. We're going to try.
Because I remember early on, I was like, oh, imagine the events you could have in the city. A real live GM could come in and plop a dragon down and have a fight that he controlled. And then other people would be like, yeah. And then it left a big crater in town, and the crater's still there, but now people live in the crater. Like, those sorts of ideas always seem to be on the table, and then nobody ever delivers these. So I'm not saying you have to do it. I'm just saying you should do it. That's all I'm saying.
You can see Coop and my blood pressure go up as Greg says this more and more. But it is something that we're enchanted by, especially if players feel like they had an impact on those events happening. Like, we talk about, you know, the Gates of Ankaraj a lot, right? The kind of the collective player effort banding together to do a thing. That's really powerful. And to your point, I don't think something MMOs do that much. Mm-hmm. The way that we're structuring our game and building our content, we think we can take advantage of that cool factor in a way that hasn't really been done before, or hasn't been done to the scale and consistency that we're aiming for.
Well, it's pretty interesting. I hope as we wind down here, I hope that things continue to just be the most creative fun you guys have ever had in your careers working on this stuff. And I can't wait to have more art discussion on the show, because it's my favorite aspect of all this stuff. I love it. Coob, do you feel like this is going to be your, you know, Mona Lisa? This is your chance to, like, all those years of art, you're dabbling in comic book art, all your running of art teams, all the stuff you've done. Is this the culmination, do you think?
This really is, Scott. Like, you know, it's one of those things where I've been very fortunate in the companies that I've been able to work in previously. But this was an amazing opportunity that would have been crazy to pass up. When I had that initial conversation with Greg, and then I started to meet all of the people that he was starting to bring together, even then was just, you know, 10-ish, you know, people. And all we've been doing since is making an incredible, talent-dense group, you know, to kind of push this game forward. It's been the most amazing year of my life so far. It's making me feel young again, which I love. And yeah, I'm just so excited to have conversations like this. Look forward to new conversations when we're bringing on others in the art team and talking about other things that we're exploring, even outside of some of the things around the biome.
Some of the questions we get a lot about after episodes have aired are like, when are we going to get to see some character, you know, concept, character art, and that sort of thing?
You will get to see it, but there are some of those things that are still in iteration, right? Like, and as great as it is to kind of pull the curtain back and show the ideas for biomes, people could be a little bit more specific or attached to things on characters. Mm. So we want to make sure that we're feeling really good about that direction. It's one of the big areas that we're working on right this second, Scott. So I am hopeful that it will be in the nearish future, but it it is definitely something that's really important to us.
Well, it's literally the thing you have to stare at the most. You got to look at the back of your dude or lady running all the time, and you may as well put your best foot forward, I suppose, on that. Well, that's awesome. Greg, any final thoughts on any of this? You pretty happy with the way all this stuff's going? This part,
I hope he says yes. It's definitely been the happiest of my career. We get to kind of make, you know, the game I've always wanted to make, with a great team that's very engaged and excited about what we're doing. Like, I love that every day we're not fighting about what should the game be, but talking about how to, you know, how to create it, how to bring it about. Seeing the visuals is when it starts to feel real, because you can imagine it in your mind, but once you can see it and talk about it and say, yeah, that's it, there's just like nothing like that in the world.
Well, we showed a bunch of really cool concept art, especially biome stuff and some creature art here on this stream today. Now, if you're only listening to the audio version of the podcast, and there are a lot of you that do it that way, I urge you to seek out the YouTube video. You can find it at frogpants.tv or over at fantasticpixelcastle.com. They also post it, and they put it on their Twitch channel and other things. So if you missed out on that part of it, please do check that out. Will there be anywhere else on the website that we know of that's going to show? I know there's the blog post from a couple of months ago, but the art we showed today, are you guys going to have that in a central place? Or
probably not. Not my plan to, you know, put all of this stuff up. I hope that people are kind of getting into the different forms of media that we have, because we're going to have a lot to show since we're showing things so early. And I'd rather be, you know, have that along for the journey. And we will highlight things. So right now we're in our milestone 3. There will be things that we will highlight once we get to that blog update for milestone 3.
Sure.
So this is just even a sneak peek at some of the things that people would be able to see that might be coming in milestone 3.
That'd be great. Seek out the video, you guys. You can find links over at frogpants.com/street as well. Yes, Greg.
Yeah, I just want to say, and part of the reason we're sharing this is we want the feedback. We want to hear what players are excited about. We want them to say, yeah, this kind of misses the mark for me. Like, again, we're not going to vote on everything, but we'd love to know what is jazzing players and what is missing the mark.
I can tell you in the chat, you were jazzing them with your biome plans. So jazz hands, everybody. We're getting places here. Very exciting stuff. Well, I appreciate having all of you on. Once again, Shanti, thank you for being here again, man. It was great having you.
My pleasure.
And you want. Yeah, for sure. And Coob, it was really great meeting you and having you on as well.
You as well. Awesome time being here, Scott.
Yep. Thank
you
very much. Look forward to future visits from both of you. And of course, Greg will be here every time. Greg, it's always good talking to you, man. I hope you're doing good.
I'm doing good.
Steam your boiled eggs, because they're easier to peel. It's something we learned pre-show. So I just want to share that with everybody. That seems really off, you know, like a tangent, but I'm telling you, if you're sick of peeling bad boiled eggs, Greg brought us the truth today. And we're all better for it.
Goes through a lot of eggs.
That's right. Real ones too, from real chickens. Anyway, that is going to do it for us. Thank you all for listening. If you would like more info or previous episodes, all that stuff can be found at frogpants.com/street. And we'd love it if you would send us your feedback. We have a text line you can use, 801-471-0462. It's also a contact form on the site. And don't forget fantasticpixelcastle.com for all the latest from the team. That'll do it for us. We'll see you next time.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Yes. Get more at frogpants.com.